open up a committee, the Senate Revenue Committee, for Tuesday, February 22nd. Committee, today we are going to begin, and it's going to last 2 days, and then I think we'll come back to it in a few days. Today we're going to hear from several folks who are involved with the state of urban renewal as it is today. We've decided to use, and the good mayor, former mayor of Oregon City, has allowed us to do this, use his bill as a vehicle to have a discussion on urban renewal as a whole. And I'd like to really, what we'll do in the next couple of days is just look at about six or seven different ideas or proposed changes to the state statutes on urban renewal. And after 2 days, we'll try to get together and decide if there are enough concepts that we agree on that we could put into Senate Bill 412 and move forward to the House. Dr. Ayala, would you give us an overview of what we've got today?
It'd be my pleasure. This morning we've asked four experts in their areas of urban renewal to speak to you on different issues, and we've tried to, it'll be informal, I hope, but we've tried to schedule it between 8:30 and 10, so each speaker knows relatively how much time they have. And we've brought together John Phillips from the Department of Revenue and Karen Williams, former counsel to the Portland Development Corps, Jeff Tashman, affiliated with the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, and Mr. Wade Fickler, from the Research Director for the City Club of Portland. And if you'd like me to introduce John, you could begin the orientation.
Yes, I would. But right before we do that, the bill that we will have a public hearing on tomorrow, and a number of folks to testify tomorrow, deals with just the school component. And so we'll begin that discussion in earnest tomorrow. But today should be a good day for background and to hear the report from the City Club. With that, Mr. Phillips, would you like to lead us off? And Ms. Williams, if please come, and Mr. Tashman.
All three.
Boy.
We thought we'd save time and all come up with
us. You guys have talked and organized in advance.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. Three of us are here today to talk a little bit about urban renewal. I'd like to cover just a little, very brief historical overview, and then we'll get more into the policy and application. I've got two handouts, one that's a very detailed, sort of three-page, below-by-below history since roughly 1990, and then there's a two-page handout that's blue in color on the front, and that's just our little information circular that the department publishes to help citizens understand a little bit about urban renewal, and then some statistics on the back. With that, I'd like to talk again about the legislative history. Back starting in 1990 with Measure 5, we were on a levy-based system. But let me stop a second here. Maybe just an orientation to the overall concepts of urban renewal would be better than jumping right into the legislation. Jeff, did you want to?
Sure, I can do that. This is a copy of a short overview that I did, and it would be good to work from that, so I'll wait to start talking until you have it in front of you. But in the meantime, my name is Jeff Tashman, and I am a consultant in urban renewal. I'm a consultant to the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. And before, as a consultant, I worked for the Eugene Urban Renewal Agency, and then for 7 years was the director of the Tualatin Development Commission, and started consulting in 1991.
So, Mr. Tashman, you know, I think what would be helpful, if we're going to spend 30 to 40 minutes on this panel, and we'll interrupt you and ask questions, but if you started us with, here was, and this Mr. Phillips kind of ventured down this path, but here's how urban renewal got started, and here's basically how your urban renewal program works, not selling us on it, obviously, but just giving us kind of a state of the state of urban renewal.
Okay. Very briefly, there is a document on the AORA website that has a pretty substantial history of urban renewal in Oregon. But, you know, very briefly, it grew out of a federal urban renewal program that required matching funds from local government to do projects that at that point were mostly housing oriented, and they were oriented to improving slum areas in inner cities. In 1960, the 1959, the voters of Oregon approved a constitutional amendment to create tax increment financing, which was seen as was going to be the source of the matching funds for the federal money. During the 60s, the federal money for urban renewal got folded into community development block grants and then went away. And the system of tax increment financing stayed, but now it was responsible for all of the money that was going to urban renewal. For the first couple of decades of urban renewal, it was pretty much a big city phenomenon. There was Portland, there was Salem, Eugene, some other smaller agencies, but predominantly the big cities that did it. And by the time Measure 5 passed, it had the use of urban renewal had spread considerably and was being used in small communities as well as large communities, counties as well as cities, and really very broadly distributed across the state. Over the last, I would say, 15 years since Measure 5, there's been a really intense interest in urban renewal in many communities. If you go back 15 years, there are many communities that have adopted plans in that period of time. The ultimate rationale for, or the underlying reason as to why they adopted these plans was because it's one of the few remaining financing tools that local governments have to make improvements in an area. And the other key part about it is it's a flexible program and it's controlled locally. I mean, all of the, within the framework of the state statute, the decisions about how to use this tool are made at the local level by the Urban Renewal Agency, which is most usually the same as the governing body of the municipality. The programs that I worked on, and there are other examples in testimony that I was going to deliver later, but to just talk about the programs I worked with personally, in Eugene, it was responsible at the time I worked there for the development of the Eugene Conference Center, the Hilton Hotel, a mixed-use office and retail project on the mall, and a substantial housing project on the west side. And it's continued to finance improvements. In Tualatin, there were two programs. The program downtown Tualatin, which literally didn't exist, it was platted but not developed, is now the site, and it was the site of a pet food plant that a lot of people remember from its odor. And now that's the site of Tualatin Commons, which is like a nationally recognized mixed-use development with housing and commercial uses. The other program was an industrial economic area on the west side of Tualatin that required infrastructure investments. Those investments were made, and it's now there are thousands of jobs, literally thousands of jobs generated in that area. The biggest single company there is a company called Novellus, which has invested $150 million, $200 million in their first phase. So those were the programs I've been involved in. There are, in my view, some notable successes statewide. And if I could take a minute to just...
We're not interested yet in the successes.
Okay.
And so
great.
We'll get there, but
okay.
This is our chance to know how the system works so that when we're looking at legislation, we want to be kind of all on the same page.
Okay. As John will get into, and Karen, the urban renewal changed drastically with Measure 50. And the key point is before Measure 50, the impact of urban renewal was on taxpayers who paid more taxes because of urban renewal. After Measure 50, the impact of urban renewal is on the taxing districts. Taxpayers pay virtually no more. There's an infinitesimal increase in their taxes, but the main impact is the taxing districts that levy taxes in an urban renewal area forego the tax revenues on the growth within that area while the tax increment financing is in place. And then the basic mechanism of urban renewal for all plans since 1996 is called the division of tax process. There's a diagram of that on the third page, the top of the third page in the handout. And this is the basic funding mechanism or the basic revenue generating mechanism for urban renewal. And so to go through that, the first box is the total property tax rate, which is called the consolidated billing rate, inside the urban renewal area. And it consists largely of just the permanent rates of the taxing districts. There's legislation recently that is phasing out dividing taxes for local option levies and bond levies. So more and more, it's just becoming permanent rate levies that are included. In the second box, it shows how those taxes are applied to the frozen base, which is the value, the assessed value within the urban renewal area at the time the plan is adopted. Okay, so that lower box is the box that that represents the amount of incremental of assessed value that's there when the plan starts. The box on top, called incremental assessed value, is the growth in whatever year this represents, is the growth in value over the amount that was there at the beginning. And so based on the frozen base and then the growth, the taxes are divided so that the taxes produced by the growth in the area go to the urban renewal district. The taxes produced on the base continue to go to the taxing district. And that's the basic revenue generating mechanism. For plans that were around before Measure 50, there are lots of complications, but for everything since 1996, this is the process, and moving forward, this would be the process.
And the only process.
Yes.
Post Measure 50, this is the only game in town for any jurisdiction that wishes to go forward.
From this point on, yes. And actually, the only difference since 1996 was in 2001, there was legislation that eliminated the bond levies and the local option levies from the division of tax process, so that new bond levies and new local option levies all went for either the bonds or the local option, and none of that money comes to urban renewal. So there are plans that were adopted before then and after then, so you have some changes, but this division of tax process is the main process.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Williams.
Good morning. My name is Karen Williams. I'm an attorney at Lane Powell in Portland, and I represent several urban renewal agencies and several private developers who are doing business with urban renewal agencies, though I'm not here at the request of any client today. Senator Deckard and I had an opportunity to, over time, to talk about urban renewal and how it works, and he suggested I come here today. And if, with your indulgence, do a little whiteboard exercise and draw some narrative diagrams about how all this works. So forgive me if that seems school marmish, mm-hmm. but you're here to go to school today.
We like school marmishness. Do we have, Paul, a microphone? I don't know what the rules are in terms of Karen talking without the...
Speak loudly.
Shout, Karen.
Yeah, that should pick you up. There we go.
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay. I apologize to those of you who may not be able to see that somehow. Mr. Chapman spoke about the decision the governing body of a municipality makes is to create an urban renewal area, which some people also refer to as a tax increment district. That's drawing a geographic boundary around a portion of the city or a county that the governing body makes a determination is suffering from slum or blight. There's a difference between slum and blight. Obviously, as you all are well aware, when a legislature uses two words in a statute, they do it because they mean two different things. My opinion is that slum is a condition that is the end result of blight. Blight is a continuum of an economic disinvestment in an area of real property. The criteria for identifying slum and blight in the statute, if you read them and think about them, I think that's what they indicate. And that is the history of urban renewal, which originally came from the federal urban renewal law.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Regarding slum and blight, has that actually been tested in the courts? Your interpretation of how you perceive that as to giving us any guidance as to how the courts actually would define those terms and how they're actually used interchangeably or not interchangeably?
Senator, I apologize. I've never researched the question. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that one of the mandates of statutory construction is that when a legislative body uses two different terms, they have to each have be given individual meaning. The criteria for slum and blight under the statute include an area where the improvements have less value than the real estate, an area that is suffering from dilapidation, has transportation problems, has a lack of public infrastructure to serve the needs of the population, or that is generating less property tax than the services required by the area, that is enough to support the services required by the area. Such other things as overcrowding, which we may not think of as a slum, or land use planning that is unsuitable, lot sizes that are too small to allow for economic reuse of property through redevelopment. Those are all fairly sophisticated criteria that result in a lack of the ability or the opportunity for economic investment in real estate.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So,
Karen, do you think in your practice we need to better define the word blight? Is it too broad in terms of its interpretation? I guess the question is, could it use a better definition of what blight would be?
My personal opinion is no. And the reason I say that is, as Mr. Tashman mentioned, these programs for the pregenitor to modern urban renewal has been around as a federal program for decades. And I think practitioners and local governing body politicians who work closely with these programs do understand how to identify a blighted area or one that is suffering from slum conditions. And I think there are some industry standards already. So, and I guess this takes me back to something Mr. Cashman said. Urban renewal is fundamentally a local program enabled by state law. So if there is a problem with a particular area being identified or targeted for redevelopment, I think for the legislature to leave enough flexibility for local government officials to make those decisions and then leave them with local political accountability is the better solution. So once an area is created, Mr. Tashman made reference, and I'm sure Mr. Russell would too if I let him, to the concept of creating a frozen base. We have a geographic area that has a property tax value at the time the urban renewal plan is created. So let's call that year zero. And the dollar value within the frozen base, or within the property taxes, the frozen base is down here in terms of value. In year zero of the urban renewal plan, there is zero increment for the Urban Renewal Agency to capture because the frozen base is the total of the property taxes in the area. If the area is in fact suffering from economic disinvestment in real estate or a lack of economic activity in real estate, then assuming the current system that captures taxes levied by all of the taxing jurisdictions within the geographic area, the curve is going to be relatively slow, and if urban renewal is successful, the growth in incremental value will take off in later years of the plan because the plan will have been successful and will spur catalyzing or synergistic economic development in the private sector. An example of how this model works is the area in South Waterfront, or known as the North Macadam area in Portland, that had stagnant property values or virtually stagnant property values for some 20 years because the area is a geographic transportation island. There is an inability to get enough ingress and egress into the area to allow for redevelopment, even though this large area of land, approximately 130 acres, is immediately south of downtown Portland. In order to solve that problem and allow this curve, the Urban Renewal Agency has to make some, approximately, Chip Lazenby, their general counsel, is here. He can correct me if I misspeak. Some approximately $70 million in transportation and infrastructure improvements in order to enable the development that will cause significant growth in property tax values in the area.
About $100 million.
Thank you. For the microphone, Mr. Lazenby corrected me. It's about $100 million.
Now that we've opened that door, I think we're going to have, you know, the cheering section back here. As,
So what this means is that there is. Let me back up here a little bit. So when the Urban Renewal Agency gets to a point in growth and property value where there is some room between the frozen base and the dollar amount of increment, the Urban Renewal Agency can go to the market and sell a tax increment bond. A tax increment bond is a security that is sold in the bond market, and for the payment for which is generated by the tax proceeds. The reason for financing urban renewal with bond sales is so that the future tax receipts can be accumulated at as early to the beginning of the plan as the economics allow in order to create a nest egg of funds to do things like those large expenditures for transportation and infrastructure to spur the rest of the development. So we get to about here, and the urban renewal plan generates enough tax increment to both debt serve a 20-year bond and to have enough excess revenue above the amount required for debt service to satisfy bond covenants. The reason the bond covenants are there and this, if you will, debt service cover must be there is because the property tax receipts have to be what the bond market calls seasoned. They have to be proven up. And there has to be enough room that if there's some initiative or legislative change in property taxes, or if there's an economic downturn and property values actually decrease, there'd still be enough money there to debt serve the bond. So when the bond is sold, it generates money with which to do projects, and the presence of those projects hopefully increases the property tax values over time and creates a success in the urban renewal plan. However, how this curve works and when there is enough cash in the urban renewal plan to do the typical projects that change the course of a particular geographic area depends on what, as Mr. Cashman's diagram demonstrated, what the total consolidated rate is times assessed value in the plan area. Currently, And some urban renewal plans work on a curve like this. Some urban renewal plans work on a curve that looks more like this. And some work on a curve that looks like this. Depending on the nature of the properties involved, for instance, residential properties are not likely to grow as quickly as a commercial or industrial area might. Depending on the tax levies of the local jurisdictions, and depending on the nature of the problem that's creating the blight, and the activities that need to be done in order to solve the problem.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Williams? Can you, and this may require a raising or if there's a flip side, but when we chatted previously, you mentioned one idea that you had, which would be allow a city to, I forget the term that was used, but basically stop and not have to levy to the full extent or not have to move to the, do you recall the idea? It was.
Senator Duckett, as I recall, the conversation was about kind of in a broader context of if there are problems with urban renewal, how should those problems be addressed? And you and I talked about several alternatives. I think the fundamental message is that urban renewal is a local process undertaken by local elected officials. Part of the conversation we had and that you all will hear more about is, for instance, in the City Club report, there is a local political process going on in Portland right now that is, in my view, exactly the kind of public debate that should happen about urban renewal. So, Senator, one of the questions you had was how to facilitate more local political accountability.
Or to give options. I mean, the one, and it looks like you're heading in that direction, but the one that was intriguing was, if I'm mayor of Grants Pass and want to, 10 years in, no longer, a lot of the aspirations of the urban renewal district have been achieved, no longer have to participate to the extent in searching for the term, I think it was undervalue or...
So let's talk about this diagram again of time and property tax valuation. And if the curve looks like this, and we come to, for instance, year 5, and issued a bond that goes for about 20 years, and we come to year 9 and issue a bond that goes for about 20 years. Here, there is future capacity for future debt service in growth.
Growth in the property values.
Growth in the property tax values. As Mr. Tashman described, for urban renewal plans started after 1996, the statute now requires that until maximum indebtedness, a key term in urban renewal, is reached, and the bonds representing maximum indebtedness have been paid off. No, that's not entirely a correct statement, is it? Until there's enough... Yeah, I guess. Okay. Sorry. I'm trying not to get...
We're only making laws here.
until the bonds are paid off, the urban renewal plan continues to function, and the tax increment revenues are pledged to the bondholders and continue to be received by the urban renewal agency. In our conversation, we talked about urban renewal first needing to have the full spectrum of revenues because urban renewal is conceptually is like a property tax trust. The trust has to be managed both for the current and for the future beneficiaries. An urban renewal plan is an investment the local jurisdictions make of their ability to receive property taxes on the growth curve now to stabilize and augment their future property tax base. So local jurisdiction spends the taxes it receives from the frozen base for current needs, and it invests some of its taxes from increment within its jurisdiction to stabilize and augment its future property tax base. Just dealing with the now, obviously, is not going to take care of the needs of the future. So when they make that decision, they can make the decision about how much of that to capture and over what amount of time with several vehicles. One of them is choosing how much money they should capture in the urban renewal plan. Another is choosing for what duration of time they can issue bonds, which is in as a voluntary measure in most plans. And another is choosing the size of the geographic boundary. What you and I were talking about is that instead of having this delivery of taxes in all plans post-1996 be mandatory, giving the local government some discretion about how much of that to collect and having them make periodic decisions. Because most urban renewal projects can take years to develop and mature, having that be on a short timeline like an annual decision is probably not workable, but having it be on a longer periodic review could be workable.
3 to 5 years, or?
I'd say not less than 5 years.
Not less than 5 years.
There has to be predictability with the people with urban renewal agencies work that there will be funding there or they can't put together a project.
So Dr. Alec, if we have that concept drafted as an amendment to the bill, just and you can work with Ms. Williams to flesh it out. But, Mr. Phillips.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, John Phillips. I just on this handout that I passed out, the there's five phases I've identified, and I've identified four characteristics in each phase to sort of separate the two. Trying to think about what you might be interested in. Visibility is the first sort of pre-measure five. Visibility of urban renewal to taxpayers and to taxing districts has changed in the various changes to the statutes. The revenue has become affected local governments to some extent in more recent years, and it didn't in earlier years because of a different system we're on. Tax rates are increased or decreased, and different types of plans have been created. Do you have a question, Mr. Chair?
No.
No, you look like you have a question. So intense.
Speaking about the duck football game.
Right? Okay. No. And in the early years, in my experience anyway, back in the 90s, urban renewal plans had the ability to certify less and to ask for less than their full authority. And even currently, under some changes made in 97, certain plans have ability to not use the full amount of the increment that exists in Karen's chart up there. There's a full increment value that's above the frozen. Remember, they established this frozen base. Any growth above that we call an increment value. And certain districts can choose not to exercise the full use of that increment value. That was more the case sort of back in the Measure 5 era, back in the 90s, pre-Measure 50. And so that's one of the changes that have happened in the system. And I won't go into as much detail, but under the current law, we've had more visibility in urban renewal. It's on the tax statement. Taxing districts see more of the effect of the increment that's going to urban renewal and maybe see that as a loss. And again, that's more of a theory thing that were it not for the urban renewal agency, the theory goes, there wouldn't be an increment. So it just depends on how you look at it. There was, as Jeff pointed out, a change in the 01 session to separate some bond and local options as being non-touchable by the increment value. And all these changes create sort of a different treatment for different plans. So we've got plan areas that existed at one time that are treated a certain way. Then in 97, we've got plans that where options were created for agencies to choose plans. So we had an option 1, an option 2, an option 3 type of plan. Some of them could levy a special levy, which went on the tax statement. And that was to sort of guarantee that in the wake of Measure 50, which reduced taxes and set values, that those districts could levy what they needed to meet their debt obligations. So it gave them special levy authority. But the idea was not to let new plans get special levy authority. So we had plans that could levy special levies. We had plans that couldn't, and some that chose not to. So what we've got today is we've got a number of different types of plans. We've got existing plans, which we refer to as those that existed sort of when Measure 50 was passed. And within that, we've got Option 1, Option 2, and Option 3 plans, which can do varying things. And then if a plan has a substantial amendment, it can lose its status as an existing plan and become what we call a non-existing plan, still active. You with me? And then in 2001, when the law was passed to pull out urban local option and bond levies from the application, we call those, up until that point, we call those window plans. And then any new plans were ones that could not have the local option and bond levies revenue split between urban renewal and those levies. So we've got a number of plans there, and I just wanted to say that as we treat different plans differently and as the laws sort of progress, you'll see this through the document, that more plans with special treatment are created, and it sounds like Senate Bill 412 would become like sort of an Apple plan, which is for schools. But anyway, I just hope that gives you an idea of the visibility that urban renewal has and doesn't have, depending on the system we choose, and how that's changed over the years, and the statutes have basically created additional plans to be treated specially.
Do you know, John, this may be an unfair question, how many millions, Mr. Lasby mentioned in the project on South Waterfront in Portland, $100 million in terms of the increment financing portion. How much do we have any estimate or idea over, I don't know, a two-year period since we work in bienniums, is foregone to police, fire, and schools, but captured in tax increment financing statewide?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the closest I can get to that answer for you today right now is what's on the second page following the blue sheet. And that compares, that's as close as I'm going to be able to get. And basically all this chart does is show you how much was derived for urban renewal from the permanent rate, from special levies, and total revenue from these various agencies. It doesn't talk about the other side of it in terms of what the districts received. So this is just sort of one side of that question. But
so where's the magic figure? Total revenue, 02, 03, 03, 04?
That's what we show as being the revenue for urban renewal agencies listed for those years from those levies, yes.
So is that $134 million and then $141
million? Yes. But in order to get more to the question you've asked, I'd have to get some additional data.
Check that.
Yeah.
But we've got some volunteer. Yes, Mr. Cashman.
Then one comment I would make about that is that the easiest way to answer that question is not really the most accurate. The easiest way is you look at what's the incremental assessed value in all of these districts and what are the tax dollars that are raised on that incremental value. And in a sense, all of those dollars are coming from one taxing district or another. Now, in the case of schools, it's more complicated because, to some extent, the state backfills property taxes that are not collected. But the catch in it is that in doing it that way, you sort of assume that all of that growth would have been there without urban renewal.
I realize that.
And in many, many cases, we can demonstrate direct links between investments in urban renewal and major private investments that just wouldn't have occurred. So, you constantly, I think, need to keep in mind that, you can look at, the taxing districts are foregoing this amount of money, but you have to always think of how much money would they forego if the urban renewal program weren't there, and that's going to be a much smaller number.
Mm-hmm. So I'll allow you to keep the advocate hat on. This panel was set up to be a overview, but I know that's probably impossible when it's your life's work, too.
Well, that's just purely objective information. Never mind.
I realize. So in terms of school district, because a lot of the debate that we've had, and it's coming to a point here, is with the transfer of school funding to the state, obviously more of a responsibility on that issue than police and fire, frankly, which tend to be more locally funded and locally directed. So the question has come up many times, I think, in the last few months here. Should we really narrowly define the purpose of what we do here, and anything that takes from schools, whether that's on the exemption side or perhaps urban renewal or Measure 66 pass initiative decisions, anything now that was 5 or 6 years ago at least generally regarded as off bounds or things that weren't as discussed as much now, a lot of tougher decisions are and discussions are coming about here, especially around school financing and the desire to protect that core function of state government that we have. And that's, we're going to get into this more tomorrow, but I'd like to give you the chance to kind of push back on what is a wave that is starting to, I sense, gather on anything that encroaches upon school funding.
The one way to look at it is to just get a sense of the scale, how much of the, if you looked at all the assessed value in the state, how much of that is in urban renewal increment not being taxed by schools? And the last time I ran the numbers on that, it was 3%. You know, so that's kind of the scale of the problem, is that at that point, 3% of the total assessed value in the state was not taxed by the taxing districts in urban renewal areas. So that's a sense of the scale. And then the policy decision is, and I'm sure that Karen and maybe John have other comments to make about this, but you're always looking at trading off short-term and long-term, because in the long-term, completing an urban renewal plan will result in much more revenue for the school district or for, you know, however you look at that, or for all the other taxing districts, than it would have without urban renewal. So the long-term benefit is definitely there. Excuse me. What you're...
Karen, water's on the way.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think an example of what Mr. Tashman is all choked up about is that the approximately $100 million in transportation improvements that we've talked about for the South Waterfront area of Portland will generate over $400 million in taxable private improvements in the area that, but for the urban renewal activity, clearly could not have happened because the road system simply would not allow access to the property for that level of activity and investment. So I think the concept Mr. Tashman is so emotional about is for the local taxing jurisdictions to invest the growth for a relatively short horizon of time, relative being from a governmental or geologic perspective of relative. And for future beneficiaries is a vitally important concept of good stewardship and good policy. Perhaps a good example of that is during the robust economic times Oregon had in the last 15 years, there was a decision made in the state agencies not to make significant investments in job growth and economic development because, thank you very much, we're cooking along just fine. And I think many of us could look back now in hindsight and say, was that in fact the best long-range policy for the state? I think urban renewal represents a similar paradigm. of balancing our assets and our opportunities now, both to meet current needs and as effectively and with as much good policy and foresight as we can, also to assure the opportunities for future property tax and valuation stability. Urban renewal also accomplishes many things that are of benefits to the schools. For instance, the availability of safe, clean, decent, affordable housing for the lowest quartile of our population, or even the lowest half of our population, is absolutely critical to success in the classroom. I think most school administrators will tell you their ability to raise up a child who is involved in a difficult home situation or in a homeless situation to compete with his or her peers in academic terms is far more costly than to deal with a population of students who are enjoying safe, clean, decent, affordable housing. So those kinds of qualitative benefits are more difficult to identify than pointing to a particular column in a property tax table, but I think as a matter of policy, they are things that deserve your recognition.
Thank you. Other questions, comments?
Well, thank you. I think that was very helpful to get us started in this discussion. And as we move forward, if we'll have a public hearing on any bill that moves forward, and we'll allow you to put full pledge on your cap of advocacy and defend the program and roll up your sleeves. And but we appreciate the background and the hints at advocacy that we got this this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next panel, and Mr. Fickler, if you want to bring up anyone with you, or you're welcome to. The City Club did a extensive review. The City Club of Portland did an extensive review of urban renewal and has written a good report, about 60 pages. We've asked them to come in and talk about their findings and their recommendations and to draft amendments to Senate Bill 412 if they have specific recommendations.
Senator Decker, thank you for inviting City Club to be here today. My name is Wade Fickler. I'm the research director for City Club of Portland, and I'm joined by three members of the club. To my immediate left, David Mandel. Further down, Paul Meyer, and behind me, Paul Fellner. These three gentlemen were members of our study committee that studied the Portland Development Commission beginning in 2002 and spent about 18 months looking at the structure and processes and governance of the Development Commission. And the members of the committee are non-interested parties, all screened for conflict of interest, and came to the study with no particular expertise in the area of urban renewal. Through the course of the study, however, they gained a great deal of knowledge about not only the Portland Development Commission, but urban renewal in general and tax increment financing. And so we come to you today to share what we believe are relevant findings, conclusions, and recommendations, but offer no opinion on Senate Bill 412 as it is currently drafted. You should have a copy of our PDC report, a copy of our affordable housing report, which may be useful for you, and then a short summary excerpted from the PDC report that'll really get to the most specific points.
And since this is focused on PDC, you might just inform the committee what PDC is and how it relates to cities around the state.
Yeah. Portland Development Commission is Portland's urban renewal agency designated by the city charter. And is there anything else you'd like me to say about that?
I think other cities have similar, some have similar
yeah.
models.
PDC is a quasi-governmental, semi-autonomous agency. Not all urban renewal agencies are set up in that way. Some are, for example, the city council in some cities could be the urban renewal agency. So with that bit of introduction, then David Mandel will walk you through some testimony, and then Paul are available to answer questions as well. So I'll step back and let Paul move on up.
Thank you.
Well, first, I'd just like to begin by thanking the committee for giving us this opportunity to talk to you. You've already heard about some of the complexities of tax increment financing, and I believe my job today is to make it even a little bit more complicated. And part of what I'd like to spend some of the time today is walking you through some of the reasons why answering that question of what is the actual cost of tax increment financing to other taxing jurisdictions, why that's so difficult, at least in the period where the urban renewal district is in place. In many ways, tax increment financing is a broken tool. TIF can no longer and should never have been viewed as free money because of tax compression that resulted from Measure 5 and 50, as we've already heard from today. Tax increment funding for urban renewal competes now directly with other public services such as schools and public safety. Furthermore, and I think this is really an important issue, is the complexity makes the exact nature of this cost extremely difficult for public officials, let alone the general public, to discern, thus limiting public accountability. And its funds can only be used in urban renewal areas from which they arise and not necessarily in places where they're most needed. And what we'd like to emphasize is that the evaluation of TIF-funded urban renewal needs to take into account its cost in terms of teacher and police officers who were never hired, rivers that were never cleaned, and roads that were never repaired. Until recently, little attention was given to the cost of tax increment financing to other tax jurisdictions. When the economy was booming and property values were soaring, there seemed to be enough revenue to go around. But a combination of initiative-driven property tax reforms and slumping economy have dramatically changed the picture. And as I've already said, it's extremely difficult to know how much urban renewal actually costs other taxing jurisdictions. We do know that in fiscal year 2004, $43 million of property taxes in Portland went to tax increment financing that could have otherwise been available to other taxing and jurisdictions. As we've already heard, defenders of TIF will argue that this is tax revenue that would not exist but for urban renewal. It's often argued that tax increment financing more than pays for itself, that TIF-funded investments are supposed to result in higher property values and in turn higher property tax revenues. And there are some important numbers supporting their claims. But what I want to talk a little about today is why that's really not the full story. The real question is not simply how much faster these areas grew than surrounding areas, but how much faster they grew than if there had been no public investment at all. And it's the difficulty of addressing this but-for question that makes assessment of the true financial benefits of tax increment financing so hard to answer. You know, and I think it's important to note that urban renewal areas are chosen not just because of blight, but also because of what is seen as their economic potential. To be designated an urban renewal area, a place must be seen as right in some way for development. Thus, that property values in urban renewal districts grow at such a faster rate should not be a total surprise. Furthermore, even if these high growth rates were entirely attributable to TIF, the true financial benefit would still be unknown. Some of the growth within an urban renewal district may be at the expense of development in other parts of the city. And this is really an important issue for why addressing the but-for question is so difficult. Urban renewal dollars, rather than simply stimulating new development, may in part instead siphon off projects that would have been built somewhere else within the city's limits. And if TIF dollars to some extent are simply moving development around, they are not contributing to the tax base. So if you have a development that would have happened outside an urban renewal and you move it into an urban renewal, it would have been immediately benefiting the other taxing jurisdictions, but now, you know, during the life of the urban renewal is not. The extent to which TIF-funded urban renewal enhances the tax base and creates new jobs remains an open question. The but-for problem makes an accurate accounting of the economic benefits of urban renewal next to impossible. And despite this difficulty, the City Club believes that urban renewal agencies can and should do a better job of tracking the financial implications of urban renewal projects and of communicating those implications to affected parties. It's worth knowing, if we go back to that chart, the actual cost of you know, the but-for cost to the other taxing jurisdictions basically increases, is likely to increase over time. Right? If we think about the frozen base, it's really frozen at its nominal value. So you might even think the frozen base, its real value, is going down over time. Right? It doesn't get a COLA. Right? So we might even just sort of think about that as one way in which there's a kind of increase in cost of these projects over their lifetime, or there's likely to be an increase in cost of these projects over their lifetime to other taxing jurisdictions. Furthermore, Measure 50 has also, in some ways, significantly undermined the original rationale for tax increment financing. TIF was designed to fund projects that were not financially feasible by themselves, but yielded substantial financial benefits to businesses and properties in surrounding areas, sort of the classic public goods problem. It is these indirect benefits of the adjacent area that provide the primary justification for using public resources. Prior to Measure 50, TIF was a means for getting such indirect beneficiaries to contribute to a project that would not otherwise get off the ground. But what Measure 50 essentially did was cap the assessed value at sort of 3%, you know, not growing more than 3% per year. So as a result, TIF is now really, I think, being generated more by new investment than by its benefit to existing properties. So as a result, it might be even worth thinking about the current system more as tax leverage financing rather than tax increment financing. I think this is something that people really need to think through a little bit more, what the consequences of this are. TIF has also become, as was noted earlier, a significant source of funding for affordable housing. But once again, TIF may be a less than perfect tool. The need for urban renewal agencies to increase property values in order to generate TIF conflicts with the goal of keeping housing affordable. Raising land value through development within URAs raises the cost of housing, thereby increasing the public subsidy needed to make housing in the area affordable. TIF as a funding source also limits the flexibility in siting affordable housing. TIF must be spent in the urban renewal area that generates it, which may lead to a concentration of low-income affordable housing inside URAs. Because of this problem, the City Club of Portland recommends that the State of Oregon follow California's lead and allow TIF dollars to be exported from urban renewal areas for affordable housing. If tax increment financing is a broken tool, it still may be one of the few tools that we have left. Unlike other public funding sources, TIF dollars can be used to stimulate public-private partnerships. And unlike other public funding sources, TIF has not yet dried up. Tax increment financing can be thought of as a savings plan, a way for a city to put aside revenue for long-term investment. Given the general public's unwillingness to pass bond and other revenue measures, it is reasonable to believe that much of the good work that the Portland Development Commission has done only happened because of TIF. Without TIF, projects from East Bank Esplanade to the Chinese Garden and from Interstate Max to OHSU's expansion into the South Waterfront would probably never have been completed. So are we getting our money's worth from TIF, funded urban renewal? City Club, in the end, cannot answer this question, but the question of whether or not urban renewal pays for itself should not be confused with the question of its overall value. Along with jobs and revenue, urban renewal also contributes to less quantifiable goods, goods such as parks and green spaces, dense and vibrant neighborhoods, goods that must in the end be included in any complete satisfactory accounting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think the
questions for the committee.
Well, I think your revenue staff, your legislative staff, picked up the recommendation that we would think that you should amend the TIF to permit affordable housing funds generated within an urban renewal area to be spent outside that urban renewal area.
Mm-hmm. So we'll just have we need to get your name for the record, and then I have a question about that.
Meyer.
I think we've got that as a possible amendment to any bill, and 412 is the vehicle that would move forward. So the argument against that is that if you're looking at, and I'm trying to think of a project, but if you're looking at a project and you know and you're trying to entice private dollars into that project, obviously the TIF would provide the public dollars, a park, a streetcar,
some affordable housing, if you're trying to entice private dollars into that project, what would the effect be on the private developer that says, well, 30% of everything that goes up, now you can look at the deal from the front end to the back end and know that it's airtight. If we did adopt that amendment, I'm curious about it. It to me, as the private developer, I would then say, well, 20 or 30% most likely, if this project takes off like I hope it is, 20 or 30% of the dollars are going to then be exported outside my district and the project that I'm concerned about.
I think, in fact, this proposal would increase the ability to for urban renewal areas to generate TIFs. There's a sort of double cost of using TIF for affordable housing. One is the actual TIF dollars that go into it, but also if these are often not on the tax rolls, so they're not generating TIFs. So in some sense, it actually creates more space for TIF to be generated within a renewal area.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's actually a legit, it would be a real concern.
That's because the non-affordable housing might be a non-profit and therefore off the rolls altogether.
Off the tax.
And, you know, as it is, I can, you know, speak mostly about Portland Development Commission. They have made a real commitment to using TIF dollars already for affordable housing. This is really about giving them more flexibility in where those dollars are used.
So if you had a district that the property values were just exploding because of the urban renewal district, they would be allowed to take some of that explosion and move it over to an area that they're having much of a much more difficult time enticing that type
and,
of...
And not all urban renewal districts really are the kind of place are really suitable necessarily for siting affordable housing. You know, if we have a district that's mostly about commercial or industrial use, that may not be the best the best place to site affordable housing.
Senator Metzger.
I don't know if it's for the panel or for staff, so whoever, just help me with this a little bit. On these, on when the bond's been paid off in an urban rural district, and those properties then are off that URD, explain to me how they are assessed at that point. I mean, you know, with Measure 5 and 47 and 50, when they've been in this different zone for all these years. Now they come off. How are they assessed at that point?
They're not assessed any different. I don't think any differently. New construction is going to be assessed at its value, or at least some formulas, and I can't speak to it precisely. But that's when David talked about tax leveraging rather than increment financing. That it's basically the new construction which creates the new value now, because the incremental value that might occur to the adjacent properties, which become much more valuable because now they're in a more viable district. But that's capped by Measure 50, other than the 3%. So that isn't going to appear in the increment. So it's basically only the new construction that's going to be the source of the tax increment finance. Is that right?
Mr. Nolan said that the other tax increment deal is the park bill is being stopped for 20 years until the bonds are paid off. And then they got the pot of gold when they don't need it anymore.
And in your research, did you the folklore out there? And I remember someone mentioning to this to me about 5 or 6 months ago. And actually, it's backed up. I don't know if you got the Department of Revenue statistics, but it at least is somewhat backed up. And we're going to have Chip up here tomorrow or perhaps following this panel, is that Portland has been too aggressive, the city of Portland, and perhaps there's other jurisdictions, although this one, Portland, is way ahead of everyone else in terms of using this tool, has been too aggressive in finding different areas of the city to make urban renewal districts, and I don't know if I didn't hear it, although there is conclusions that the governance structure needs to be addressed. Is that something you think the state has an interest in, just in the governance structure of how decisions are made on on selecting urban renewal districts?
I mean, there are already the existing caps, both in terms of property and property value that can be within that can be placed within urban renewal. So there is already an upper limit. That exists now for that. I think part of the issue that we wanted to get at, which I know is slightly different than your question, was how do we make it more clear to the public what are the trade-offs when we enter into an urban renewal project? The question can no longer simply be, does this seem like a good investment in and of itself, but what are the opportunity costs? What does it mean to forego this amount for our education system, especially if we think more broadly of the education system as part of economic development, as part of what brings people to Oregon and keeps people in Oregon and makes them ready for the economy. So I think one of our main points is that the question of the return on investment can't be addressed simply in isolation without a real hard look at the kind of public investments that are also being foregone.
I think in one respect, I'm not sure what your question was totally directed to. I don't think the state legislature needs to concern itself about how the operations are internally. I think that's a matter for Portland City Council and the Portland City government to deal with. We have made some comments about the relationship between PDC and the City Council. I don't see any legislation that is required to help that process. I think the other legislation is quite adequate at this point. It's really internally how the City of Portland and its council chooses to relate to the PDC, and it could do anything it wants. I mean, City Council could simply change or have a charter amendment and take over the functions as some of the cities do themselves, as become the urban renewal agency for the city or county or whatever government. I don't think state law needs attention.
The only nexus, or the natural nexus, is the state school fund, where our eyes are firmly focused on that state school fund and the state of the state school fund. And so that's the nexus that I think you see. Discussions of whether it's ballot measure 66, which is a parks measure, but how that affects the state school fund is happening in another committee room here, and this is just the other natural outflow that I think sparks our interest.
I think there's one other. If you look at our report at the very inside of the back cover, there's an interesting chart. I think if you have copies of it in front of you. And if you look on the page 83, you'll see on the current projects the last probable date for the repayment of debt. And you'll see that they range anywhere from 2026 to 2042. And in the long run, we're all dead.
Call that the short run.
But in any event, that gives you some idea of
the longevity,
the period of time in which the pie in the sky that's going to come is postponed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that longevity makes also the whole question of what would have the property values been like without this investment much more complicated. I'm not sure any of us can really have a good 30-year projection on some of those issues.
And having said all that, we still, I think as a committee, came to the conclusion that there's a lot of good that gets done.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want to leave the impression that we're negative about the concept. We're just trying to focus on some of the issues and ways that perhaps it can be improved.
Yeah, no, we appreciate the exhaustive report. I mean, it's very helpful to have this type of activity happen prior to our arrival here in Salem, because it focuses us, and I took special note of the comments, I think it was Mr. Fickler, that said the projects that I'm familiar with, whether it's the OHSU expansion or the Pearl District or Lentz, have all benefited, or IMAX, have all been a benefit to residents, hopefully throughout the state, but certainly to those who reside in Portland and live, shop, and work and play in the city. And I think all of our focus is there changes and updates that need to be made to this program, and does the state have an interest? And we're going to get more directly into that tomorrow in terms of the whole school funding issue. Comments or questions for the City Club of Portland? Well, thank you for all the time.
If you
could have your recommendation drafted, Dr. Ayala would work with you if that is your interest. If it's not, we'll still have it drafted.
Yes.
We have about 10 more minutes. Chip, do you want to... Mayor Williams, I was going to have you up tomorrow when we focused on... you're welcome to come up today if you like, but when we focus more directly on Senate Bill 412 and we open it for a public hearing. Yes.
Got to mow the lawn tomorrow.
Oh.
My name is John F. Williams, Jr. I was mayor of Oregon City. I moved to Oregon City in 92 and became interested in this question when I saw my tax bill. But I just can't resist some of the points that were raised. I think maybe you should think about two separate bills for urban renewal, one for Portland and maybe Washington County and one for the rest of the state. Because what was outlined here doesn't apply at all to the way urban renewal has worked in Oregon City. In fact, it's my contention it hasn't worked at all. It's worked to the detriment of the schools and the city and everybody else. And I'd just like to give one example. I won't go to the board, but it talked about the value created somehow a net for the city. In the case of Oregon City, the two urban renewal areas were drawn so large to take in all the business districts of Oregon City. One bare area, which is owned by the county and the hilltop area, was called the Red Soils. That was purchased by the Urban Renewal Commission from the county, and they developed a small industrial park there. Okay, today there's about $25 million, if that, of value in that little area. That's the only project they've done in the hilltop. All the rest of the value there has been created by the existing shopping centers, Fred Meyer, two other shopping centers. They've grown. Nothing's been done for them from urban renewal money, just that one little area. Been a few streets paved here and there. But if you look at that $25 million value, which is not yet on the tax rolls, it only brings in $125,000 of taxes to the city. When it goes off the tax rolls, how many years does it take to pay back the investment? Well, the investment was $2.5 million borrowed, which means you have to double that because of the service on the debt. So you get up to almost $5 million it costs to create that little industrial park. How many years is it going to take to earn back that $5 million and $100,000 a year? 50 years. To me, in my simple mind here, it doesn't work. And the same thing applies to any other project done in Oregon City. They build parking lots, a public piece of property. They pave some streets downtown. It's public property. It generates no taxes. They bought some land around the riverfront, still not developed, brings no money to the city. In the broad sense, it just doesn't work for Oregon City in the way it does seem to work for Portland or Washington County or wherever. So it got so frustrating to me to see the line of general funds in the city go straight down like this, and the increment in the two urban areas go up, and all that money going out to wherever. It's kind of hard to account for. Where did it go to? It went to fees for consultants, it went to salaries for the city manager, it went to salaries for the engineer. It just didn't look like it worked. And so when I began to look at where the money comes from, that's how I got to this position of the school. You can absolutely identify where it went and where it came from in Oregon City. You can take the tax excess value column, I've got it in my notes, for Oregon City right now, is about $130 million. Okay, if you multiply the school rate times that $130 million, just take the $5 they're allowed to take, you get $650,000 or $700,000 of operating money that's coming from the schools. Now, I know it doesn't come directly from Portland schools, but it comes from the state. And so I just took the total of the state excess value and multiplied by an average of $5, and you get $33 million that probably came from urban renewal agents or into urban renewal agencies from the school. Now, it's pointed out that may not be correct if you get down to the nitty-gritty, but it's pretty generally the truth. The same thing with the city. $5 operating rate, you multiply that times this excess value, and you come up with $650,000 or $700,000 a year coming out of the general fund, the money that should have gone to police and fire and everything else. Now, the city manager is talking about closing the library, and they're going to pave another street. And I say, it's not working for me, because why should you pave a street when you can't keep the library open? Taxes, they're now going to ask for a dollar and a half tax raise to run the city. Well, seems to me like the money that the taxpayers are paying is going to urban renewal and not to the essential services. Not, I'll quit for tomorrow, but and one more point about on your tax statement that it's transparent. That's the word I want to talk about. But my tax statement just says urban renewal $300. It doesn't say that that came from the school, it came from the police, it came from the fire. It doesn't tell the taxpayer anything except he paid $300 for urban renewal. He might say, well, it's worth it. I make a good living. I can pay the $300. But he doesn't realize who's not getting his taxation. The county, even the vector control is not getting the money at rates. So I appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much. Before you go, let me make sure that folks don't have questions for you. Well, we'll have you, if you're free tomorrow, we're going to tee up the bill that you drafted and ask you to come back and talk about the bill.
Thank you.
Anyone else? We have a public hearing. We're not in it on 412, scheduled, because we're going to come back to that tomorrow. Anyone that came from a distance that wants to testify on that? Chip, do you want to?
I just wanted to comment on that earlier.
Yeah, please.
Well, no, I'll be back.
Former legal counsel for Governor Fitzhaber, Chip Lazenby.
And now general counsel at the Portland Development Commission. I appreciate the opportunity just to speak briefly today, and I understand I was asked by Dr. Ayala to appear tomorrow to talk more in more detail about what PDC does and how we actually work. I just wanted to answer a couple of questions. I didn't think Senator Metzger got it quite an answer to his question of what happens to those individual properties once an urban renewal district ends.
That's right.
This process is really all about dividing the taxes each year. So the individual properties, their taxes will go up as their valuations go up according to Measure 5 or Measure 50, whatever those limitations are. What happens at the end of the district, and that actually the point you identified is actually the point that defines the end of an urban renewal district, is when all the bonds are paid off, is that the property taxes that were previously going to pay the debt service on that now are returned to the divide the taxes pot for the schools and the cities and the counties on those appreciated valuations that are there. So there really isn't anything that you would see during the course of that. With respect to the last piece about seeing on your property taxes the $300, there is also a portion of that that just sort of irrevocably would go to any bonded indebtedness that's out there, so it does become more difficult to see. I think, Mr. Chair, you mentioned a proposal about making affordable housing dollars more portable outside of the districts. There are a couple of sort of allied concepts that I think the committee should keep in mind as these proposals come forward. There will be proposals to take 20% of TIF in every district and lock it up for affordable housing within that district. That may prove to be unworkable when you look at industrial districts like the new Willamette Industrial District that we've started in Portland and with our Airport Way, which is largely industrial. So the one I think you're talking about, though, is taking TIF and making it portable outside the districts for affordable housing in other areas. My only suggestion as you go forward in that is that you look to what my former boss would call the sideboards that need to be put on that. You're going to end up with the bond folks coming in and telling you that if they are loaning money to be spent in a specific area and then suddenly the law changes that money can be moved around, that can change the price of your money and their willingness to loan money in those circumstances. You may want to make that for future districts or something along those lines as those come forward. But there are a number of things. And then California has a very tricky system that I think might not be a nice overlay on the Oregon system, just as Prop 13 wasn't an overlay on our system immediately right away. So those are the things that I wanted to talk. And there was also mentioned that the city council could abolish the Portland Development Commission, take it over. In the statutes, there's a provision that if that happens, all of the current debt has to be repaid to do that. And I think that's just a financially untenable, mm-hmm. it's an untenable option in a lot of mm-hmm. ways. So I look forward to talking to you more about my organization tomorrow.
Thank you. Any immediate questions that we wanted to ask Mr. Lazenby? I have one for today that we'll get into more directly, schools, police, and fire tomorrow. But as you look at the Department of Revenue chart, it is clear that we in Portland have used this much more aggressively than anyone around the state. And why is that? Why has PDC been so and Mayor Williams talked about maybe there's two solutions here, one for the metropolitan area and one for the rest of the state.
I think it's more a matter of longevity than anything else. I mean, the organization was created in 1958. We've had, I think, as many urban renewal districts expire as we have today in existence. So it's been a process that we've used over and over again. I think the but-for question, which seems to linger in all of this, Mr. Chair, is as I heard, I was amused by a lot of the former speakers saying, you know, the but-for test is very difficult to quantify, and then they resolved it in favor of their own arguments. And I think you're going to find it happening all through. But if you look at Ms. Williams' diagram, when you talk about this rise in value curve, one of the things that happens in our older districts is that above the maximum indebtedness line, there is value that was created by the development that's being captured that's going to the cities and the schools right now. And that is that long term where you don't have to look out to 2026 to see a return. There's a return already in the values that are out there because of the investment net of the debt that has to be served. So I think we'd have to define what you mean by too aggressive to specifically answer your question.
Chip, for me it is, and it's hard to judge. You'd be the best judge because you've worked in this building and you've been at PDC for a few years. Is there a culture that takes place that... and I think it's somewhat natural if you're working with an agency to always be on the look. Well, what could we do here? What could we do here? That kind of looks like blight. That could be blight, and we could do some really interesting things here. And there's if we can draw the line here, there's some real assets to be. We get to be developers, which is one of the wonderful things that PDC has done is help and entice development. But I guess I would answer yes, but that's not a learned yes. That's just a guess that, yes, you probably...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that one of the positive aspects of the City Club Report, and I don't agree with all of it, but I think one of the positive aspects of the City Club Report is that it stresses this issue of us needing to be more strategically focused as a community in terms of what it is that we really want to do. I think that if you look at, for instance, the South Waterfront development, where we're basically coordinating a $100 million public investment to bring an additional $400 million in private investment that's going to create tens of thousands of jobs and places for people to live, that's a sound investment that will pay off in other ways, not in the way that if we were a private investment company, you'd look and say, well, we're going to get $250 million back. Not that kind of return, but in the substance, what goes on in the city. For schools and jobs and increased revenues, we do need to be more deliberate, I think. I think that those decision-making processes need to extend beyond the commission itself. I think the commission, and I'll touch on this a little bit tomorrow in my presentation, I think the commission suffers from living in that crevice between public and private sectors, in that people in the private sector, as you know from working with architects in your private life, they need to move quickly, and they don't often have time to stress process over product. And I think that's one of the difficulties that an organization like PDC has is in living in that crevice is that we're pulled in a lot of private sector ways that don't accommodate the public process. But I think that's the basic structure of the way urban renewal agencies work as defined in 457, which would be your purview, I think that's worked pretty well for a period of time and should stay there. We may need to have some more flexibility on how we can use TIF. That's going to be buffered by the bond markets. It's going to be buffered by a number of other interests that are out there, too.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Good to see you all.
Paul, do I need to open up a hearing on 412, or are we fine? sensitive information. Great. We are then, we will close our informational hearing and adjourn ourselves until tomorrow at 8:30.
Find the letter?
No.